The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not
because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Friday Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. Glad to be here, and thank you all for being here on this Space Show program. Lots to talk about. Let's run through the announcements, and we will be right with you for the content of the show, which I think you're going to be really impressed with. Today, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on air as soon as possible. Also, do remember, we'll hold you over a break, so don't let an upcoming break stop you from making a call. By the way, if you hear a lot of cracks and whistles as if you're eating Rice Krispies for breakfast or something like that, we're having heavy rains in the San Francisco area, and that always puts some line noise in on the telephone, which is what we're using. So that's why you're probably hearing some crackles. It's because of rain and water in the old infrastructure boxes out on the street. Okay, email drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. And then remember also that we are trademarked, copyrighted, and all of that good stuff. So you can download these shows, you can share them, you can archive them, you can pass them around, but please don't do anything commercial and no edits to the programs as well. We podcast, and Andrew Grummet at Gigadial, G-I-G-A-D-I-A-L, is our podcasting client. You'll find the RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast on our website and in both of our newsletters. We're also in iTunes, search for The Space Show or my name, Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, and a host of other places. If you do have any problems with our podcast, please let me hear from you, okay? And then also do remember that if you go to our website, thespaceshow.com, our comprehensive newsletter is there. It has all of the details of the week's programming, the guest bio, and it also has a future events section. And this is the only place you'll find the future events section, by the way. It's also where we will announce changes, problems, program alterations, guest alterations, any special announcements we want to get out to everybody. This is where you'll find it first. So do check the website newsletter. Just go to thespaceshow.com. You'll see it in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. And then if you want to subscribe to our very short email newsletter, send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we'll be happy to enter that to you. It goes out early Monday morning, California time. And as I said earlier, everything we're doing is archived on our website. You can either listen right off of our site, or you can easily download the shows. We have a store on our website. It's up near the top. It's called Space Show Gear. Please do check it out, and hopefully you'll find some things that work for you for the holiday season. Also, you'll see a Support the Space Show button. Remember, the Space Show is part of OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and it is a 501c3 nonprofit and California Public Benefit Corporation. We're still in the throes of our 2010 annual campaign. If you are looking for making donations, tax donations that you need, something like that, please do consider the Space Show. I mean, all of you get the content for free. There's no doubt about that. But the truth is, it's not free. It's not free to the space show. It's not free to me. And it is your gifts and your contributions that keep this program on the air. And I'm not kidding about that. So I know we got a lousy economy. Hey, it's lousy for space, too. So any support you can throw our way, we know there's a lot of great organizations out there deserving of your support and your attention. But we do appreciate those of you who support us, will support us, and have been supporting us. Then do remember that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they're promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, you can get that at their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And then I want to call your attention again to the Space Show blog. These programs are also archived on the blog. You can comment about the program. I know that just a few of you seem to be commenting, but it's really for everyone. So don't be intimidated by side discussions that get up on the blog. Come on, you all know what the blogosphere is like. And, you know, the Space Show blog is no different, even though I wish it were different. So do use it. Post your comments, and we'll make sure the guests see them. And if you have material relevant to the show, upload it. But if it's not relevant to the show, I'll take it off. The blog address is http://thespaceshow.wordpress.com. So I'm really happy, after way too long of an absence from the Space Show, to bring back my friend, but a true space pioneer and space industry guru. He'll probably not like that description. But Rex Ridenour is back with us. And for the first 20 years of his career at Hughes, Lockheed, Utah State University, JPL, Microcosm, Space Dev, and even Blastoff, Rex held key technical leadership positions on 20 pathfinding leading-edge space missions and projects as a spacecraft systems engineer, test conductor, mission engineer, mission planner, mission architect, project engineer, and study leader. Some of his more notable missions that he was part of include Viking and Mars, the Hubble Space Telescope, some of the first shuttle-launched commercial communication satellites, Voyager Neptune, Deep Space One, Shuttle Getaway, Special Experiments, SurfSat, and HGS-1. And then he has become an entrepreneur. Look, his full bio is up on the website already because he's been a previous guest on the show. It's better to talk to Rex, but you're going to hear, you know, from the real McCoy, a guy with all the experience and the successes and everything under his belt. His current focus is on growing his company, Ecliptic, and supporting the expansion of commercialization of space. He has his MS degree in aeronautics from Caltech and his BS in aerospace engineering. What is this? Something like cum laude, whatever that means, from Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. And when you look at shuttle launches and you see all those totally cool pictures, you know, as the shuttle reaches for the heavens, that's his camera. What a great guest to have back on the Space Show. Rex, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, David. Glad to be back on the show. It's been a couple of years.
Too long.
Yeah, good to be here.
You were on in September of 2008. So, you know, we're talking basically a little more than 2 years. Give us an update of what you've been doing, what Ecliptic has been doing, how your focus has grown and expanded, and my God, the things that are on the table today for space policy discussion, we didn't even dream of them in 2008, did we?
Yeah, I know. A lot of the changes happening are really big ones. And I think we're going to dedicate part of this show to that later. But first, I'll give you a summary of the stuff we've been doing at Ecliptic since the last show we were on. Picking up from fall of 2008, as you know, we have fairly frequent launches of this main product family at Ecliptic called Rocket Cam, which is basically an onboard video system used on rockets and spacecraft. Just since the last show, 2 years ago, a little bit more than 2 years ago, we've been on 9 different shuttle launches, 2 Delta IIs, 2 Atlas V, our first launch on the Minotaur IV launch vehicle this last spring. We've been on 4 launches of Missile Defense Agency-sponsored target launch vehicles that launch targets up for testing the missile defense shields around the world. Been on Ares 1X, which was the first and only launch of the Constellation program. The Orion pad abort test, if you remember that from White Sands, where a prototype Orion capsule was lifted up and the whole abort sequence was tested out. We were on that one. And probably my favorite of the whole bunch about a year ago was we were on the L-Cross impactor to the moon with our system. And then more recently, they weren't exactly launches, but they were still very exciting, the Spaceship Two glide test recently. We were on those, as well as the White Knight 2 carrier aircraft. And then just before the last show, we had just turned on one of our cameras that's looking back at the Earth from geosynchronous orbit on a an EchoStar spacecraft, EchoStar 11. That was since turned into what's called Dish Earth Channel. It's the part of the Dish Network system. And it's still on 2.5 years later. It's been on continuously. It provides a 24/7 all-around the year view of the Earth from geosynchronous orbit with no commercial interruptions and no advertising. It's just that view. And that's pretty cool. If people have seen it, they probably know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, you should go to Dish Channel 287 and watch that for a while. It's unique. So that's been keeping us really busy all this time. Another trend with all of that, we've been launching like crazy, and all of those were successful, by the way, and all of our launches have been successful. We're up to 89 now that we've been on since we started this product family. And underlying all of that, over the last 2 years, we've migrated our product family from the core is an avionics unit that we call a digital video controller. We've redesigned that to be much smaller and much more capable, and now almost all of our customers are ordering this much, much smaller system. And it's the actual controller unit's smaller than a CubeSat, if your listeners know what those things are. Roughly 4 by 4 by 4 inches, but ours is actually smaller than that. So anyway, it's been quite a slog to get through all of that development, but now almost all of our customers are ordering that new system, which builds in a lot more options for people. So that's a thumbnail summary of what we've done. We've delivered a lot of flight hardware that hasn't been launched yet for probably another 15 or 20 missions, and I can go through those shortly if you want.
We will do that. One of the things that we should say up front is offer our congratulations, by the way, to SpaceX and all of the crew there for an amazing Falcon 9 launch the other day. And the Dragon, I want to make sure we get that out there early in the show. The pictures, everything coming back were really amazing. On your EchoStar project, are there any is there any narrative or is it just a picture?
It's a constant video stream only with a time tag on the bottom to show you what time it is. And the only other thing happening is there's background music that EchoStar selected, and I believe it's fairly easy listening rock music from the 70s and 80s or something like that. I usually don't turn that on when I'm watching, but that's the soundtrack. There's no commentary, no commercial interruptions, no human voices except the singing of whatever song is playing. That's it.
I want to make another announcement because of the rainstorms that we're having. The Doctor Space at thespaceshow.com, which is a Microsoft Exchange server account, has seemed to quit working. Not unusual for the rainy season in San Francisco. So to send in questions by email, please, your best address is going to be dmlivings@yahoo.com, or you can use the following, david@davidlivingston.com. But do not use Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com until further notice. And again, I apologize, but we're vulnerable during heavy Bay Area windstorms and rainstorms, and that's what we're having right now. do you see, let's just go into some of the things, because you've been putting some attention into the commercial side and into the emerging things like Spaceship Two and all of that. Good future in that arena, a good future for Ecliptic to expand its product line, or do you think you're going to have good customers there?
Yeah, there's certainly some potential for growth in that whole arena. Of course, like any new entrepreneurial arena, there's going to be a lot of companies that fail and just don't go very far, but there will always be some successes. And so there's some good prospects. For example, for us, we're talking with Virgin Galactic about they're building this fleet of spaceships, five Spaceship Twos and two carrier aircraft beyond the ones they're testing right now. They just broke ground for that facility up in Mojave to build those things about a month and a half ago. And each one of those spaceships and the White Knights that carry them will need an onboard video system. And most of those customers in the spaceships, anyway, would like high definition for that video system to capture their ride and capture all those memories. So that's one thing we would love to have, is the job to outfit those vehicles with that sort of equipment. And so that's certainly one of the opportunities. Bigelow Aerospace is certainly... They certainly have a lot of potential as long as, Mr. Bigelow says, as long as they can solve the crew transportation problem. Their vision is very grand, and they have lots of plans to build lots of modules. So they've just about topped out the building in North Las Vegas to manufacture those modules, and it's, I believe, 185,000 square feet. It's not a small thing, and each one of those modules is going to be relatively large and have lots of equipment on board, and there's quite a few things we could do for them. So we're actively talking with them about that, too. SpaceX, you normally would think, would be a great opportunity for suppliers, but as you know, Elon Musk's core philosophy with that whole company is to vertically integrate, so something like 90% of the entire vehicle and everything around it is done in-house. So there's actually few opportunities for outside suppliers to grow much with SpaceX unless they change their philosophy, which I don't anticipate they will.
What about opportunities with Ariane and the foreign ones? Does ITAR impact you in this technology, or do you have a free hand to market into those arenas?
No, all of our stuff directly helps the host platform build a better rocket or build a better spacecraft. So everything we do is totally under the ITAR umbrella. And because of that, I actually don't try to market overseas much, because there's still a lot of growth here in this country that isn't affected by ITAR, and so it's so much easier to market here. So I basically don't do much overseas unless the opportunity just falls right in my lap. And before the global economy turned down, we actually did get a very serious inquiry from Ariane 5 to outfit all of those vehicles with video, but as soon as the economy turned sour and the currency exchange rates got back more to normal, all those discussions stopped. And I still don't think they've outfitted the rockets with video on any kind of a normal basis.
I don't seem to think that I've seen it, so I would tend to agree with you.
I've seen it on a few Atlas V, but I don't think it's a standard equipment kind of thing like it is on the shuttle here, for example. And we've gotten inquiries from other rocket programs here and there, but nothing's gone as far as actually asking for a real quote or anything, which is what you need to apply for the ITAR export approval, is evidence of a real purchase order. You know, a very real prospect for a purchase order is what kicks that whole process off. And we haven't seen any evidence of that yet.
Okay. Here's your first question, and this is from Bill in San Diego, California. And Bill says, given your vast experience, I'm curious to know how you would summarize the new directions we're going in space policy from all of the years in which you were working, where the government and NASA seemed to be the focus, but now they're seeming to be less and less of a focus as the privates take over or try to take over. How do you see the change, the transition, and the history?
Well, thanks for the question, Bill. Actually, when I started my career right out of grad school here in Southern California, I went straight to Hughes Space and Communications. which at that time was the world leader in building commercial geosynchronous spacecraft. And they, by and large, pioneered that whole business area and were right on top of their game when I hired in the late 70s. And so for the first 5 years or so of my career, that's all I saw was this top-of-the-heap leading-edge commercial space company doing what it does best. And that's shaded my thinking from then on everything else I've done. And frankly, back then, there wasn't much of a better example of a well-run commercial space company than Hughes Space and Communications. They were on the front end of everything being done on shuttle, on expendable launch vehicles with new technologies, new techniques, new operating modes, all that stuff. So virtually everything since has been a disappointment to me on how it's been operating, seeing how the Hubble Space Telescope was developed, even some of the cool missions at JPL, more recently all the stuff with the NASA human program. All of that's been a big disappointment compared to what I saw early in my career, and that's one of the reasons I left all of that to start doing things on my own, because I'd seen a good example of how you should do it, and that's what I'm trying to do. So my general impression is that that sort of pioneering commercial spirit was almost lost until recently, and now we have pretty good examples of that coming back with Virgin Galactic and how aggressive they are, and also with SpaceX more recently than that. It's just terrific to see other companies doing that sort of thing where they have a very clear direction, very clear focus, they're under their own control, and they just make things happen. And so that's really, really encouraging for me. Most of the other examples of these very complicated interagency and multi-center developments like you see at NASA, I think they're very inefficient and not going to make nearly as much progress. So I'm just thrilled with the change of pace these days. And it's like one of these once-in-a-career changes you like to see where things just start heading in a new direction.
Do you think the market is there to support the the new guys, the commercials? Because so far their primary customer is the government.
Well, not Virgin Galactic.
Well, no, not for Virgin, but for SpaceX.
Yeah, I think Virgin
Orbital.
Galactic, if they continue to execute like they have been, will have a terrific business going in just a few years. And who knows where they'll go with that. But they certainly have a good track record with the Virgin Group, developing and expanding businesses. So
yeah, the best.
Thrilling.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think it's all going to be about space tourism either. It's going to be a lot more than that someday. With SpaceX, that was totally started as a commercial company, and NASA wasn't really part of the picture, and they managed to earn a place in that queue to do costs and everything, so they are getting quite a bit of funding from NASA. That's because they're making milestones, and I think all indications are their rockets are going to be a lot cheaper than anything else for the similar capability, and it looks like they're going to be relatively flexible, and they can do several things with those rockets. So I think if you look at the manifest, sure, Elon has rocket launches scheduled with NASA and with other parts of the government, but they also have quite a few commercial customers lined up already. And I believe once they prove those rockets out a little more, the commercial interest will actually improve, because typically these commercial companies that are kind of watching the bottom line are a little bit more risk-averse at the beginning of some of these programs, and they're not willing to order until they see some proven track records. So I'm guessing there's a lot of folks pulling out their checkbooks right now, writing contracts with SpaceX. So I'm really upbeat about that.
Well, everybody should be. I mean, what they accomplished the other day was pretty amazing for a private company, and of course they're doing it at a fraction of the cost of what, the feds do something.
Yeah, and I'm really quite optimistic about Bigelow and his vision as well, as long as he gets fairly cost-effective human transport up and down. And as you might know, most of their customers they've signed up so far with memorandums of agreement or whatever are foreign countries that want to actually have something going on with humans in space, but they can't afford to do it on their own, and they really don't want to work with NASA or the Chinese or the Russians on that. So I think his first six or seven customers are actually these foreign countries that have signed intents to use his facility if he gets the transportation problem solved. So that's encouraging.
It certainly is encouraging. Tom in Denver, Colorado says, are you at all involved or do you have any thoughts on the idea to get a secondary income stream from the suborbital tourist vehicles by launching cargo and scientific experiments and small payload missions?
Yes, we're quite interested in participating in that part of the business. We're supporting and actually co-sponsoring the next conference on that whole idea, which is the Next Generation Suborbital Science Conference. The first one was held in Boulder last February. Next one's in Orlando, Florida, also in February. And the very first conference had over 320 attendees, very popular, lots of interest. Our interest at Ecliptic is, of course, all those suborbital vehicles, whether they're doing science or tourism, will probably have some sort of onboard video system. And more importantly, if you're doing suborbital science, a lot of those science experiments need controllers to control their experiments, handle the data, possibly record all that. And we have a family of avionics that do a very good job of that. And it's proven stuff. It's been on rockets and spacecraft already. And it's a pretty good fit for some of these experiments, both size and price-wise. So I'm looking at opportunities in that area. Secondary payload experiment kind of application of what we do.
Cool opportunities coming forward. Did you, when you started out, excuse me, and you went to work with the large aerospace industry, did you contemplate down the road a thriving commercial sector that was really, you know, revenue independent of the government? Was that even in people's consciousness?
Well, yeah, sure. When I started, I was in that business, at Hughes Space and Communications. That was a very big business globally at that time, you know, many billions of dollars. And I just expected that would continue in other areas. Virtually the only other area it's really that sort of philosophy is propagated into is the remote sensing market from low Earth orbit. It's not nearly as big as the global geosynchronous and low Earth orbit communication satellite business, but it's there, you know, with GOI and those kinds of programs. To some extent, the commercial launch and commercial tracking and control parts of some of these missions has been turned over to commercial interest. And so you add all that up, and it's since 1997, actually, globally, more business is done commercially than through all the governments of the world. And those two curves crossed in 1997, and they're never going to cross back again, I don't think. So unbeknownst to many people, even in the space business, I think, is that already the global space economy is dominated by commercial activity. It's about two-thirds commercial and one-third government now, and it has been since pretty much 1997. And my hope at the time when I got out of college was that this sort of commercial activity and the commercial business practices would expand beyond geosynchronous orbit and eventually, basically dominate the moon and eventually go on to near-Earth asteroids and Mars. And I didn't expect it to go much farther than that, but Earth, Moon, Mars is where I thought it would be by about now. Of course, we all know that not a single commercial activity has been done beyond geosynchronous orbit except the one project I was on in 1998, which was the salvage of that commercial geosynchronous spacecraft that swung by the moon. That's the closest commercial's ever gotten to the moon right now.
What was the name of that project again?
It was started out, it was the AsiaSat-3 satellite, which got stranded by a proton upper stage failure into the wrong orbit. Never could make geosynchronous orbit from there using conventional techniques. But using some clever trajectory techniques that were developed by a guy at JPL, we threw that idea into Hughes at the time, or Hughes Global Services actually owned the satellite at that time, and they implemented that trajectory idea in a varied form and sent the spacecraft by the moon a few times to shape the orbit using the lunar gravity assist and actually got it back into geosynchronous orbit. So it swung by the moon several times before it went back to geo. And that's the only commercial spacecraft that's ever been that far.
Interesting. Why do you think that is? Is it just the market's not there yet, or is it a capabilities issue, or what?
I mean, all this stuff is hard, so even launching a peanut into low Earth orbit is a really hard thing to do. So it's hard to get to the moon, but it's not impossible, and plenty of organizations have done it. I believe the main drawback is just that the right combination of a technical team with the right funding and the right durability of that funding hasn't happened yet. I personally think I was on the team that got the closest with 49 other people. That was at Blastoff Corporation. We got very close, but our funding ran out because our funding source was a dot-com billionaire, and that was right at the peak of the dot-com bubble. And the bubble popped, and our funding went away. So we were paying on the rocket. We had flight hardware coming in 2 weeks after we shut down. That's the first part that was supposed to show up, and everything was going along at a pretty good pace. And we were, I think, about 18 months from launch. And I thought we had a really good concept, and so did some outside peer reviewers. So I think that would have worked if we had kept our funding, but it didn't survive.
Listeners, we're going to take our first break. We're at that point. Please remember that our main email address is not working, so use dmlivings@yahoo.com, or you can use david@davidlivingston.com. And, of course, the toll-free number when we come back, 1-866-687-7223. Stay where you are. Back with Rex in about 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Friday Morning Space Show. Our guest today, Rex Ridenour. And again, due to the storms in the San Francisco area, our main email address, as well as our website, is down because EXO Communication in San Francisco has lost its power. So they are aware of it. They are working on it. We're getting hit by some pretty heavy storms, so that's what's going on. Please use dmlivings@yahoo.com, or you can use david@davidlivingston.com, and there won't be a problem. The toll-free number, which, of course, is preferable, 1-866-687-7223. So, Rex, let's pick up with the theme that we are really fortunate to be in such a unique place and moment in time in regards to space development, space policy, and what it can do for everybody.
Yeah, I'm really thrilled with two significant trends that actually are related to each other going forward from here that are happening right now, and it's a very exciting time. One is that essentially about 5 years from now, we will have, as a species, completed the first order exploration of our entire solar system. And by first order, I mean we've visited most of the key places for the first look around. We've done almost all the other planets, but we still have Messenger that will be orbiting Mercury next March. And after a year or so, we'll know a whole lot more about Mercury than we do now. We haven't orbited in any asteroids yet anywhere. We've only passed by them shortly, briefly. But Dawn, this mission that NASA is sponsoring, is actually going to start orbiting Vesta in the main belt asteroid in July next year. And it'll leave there a couple years later and go to another big asteroid called Ceres and get there by 2015. Mars Science Laboratory will land on Mars in 2012. Rosetta is going to try to land on a comet in 2014, and then New Horizons will pass by Pluto, the Pluto system, in 2015. And so with the end of that mission, that flyby, except for some Kuiper Belt object that they may go by someday, we will have looked at everywhere in the solar system to first order. That's really exciting to me, because now we have all those first order questions answered, and we can start going into the second order questions.
What is a first order question as compared to a second order question?
Well, first order question is like, you know, what's the basic makeup of every planet? You know, does it have a solid core or liquid core? What's the general characteristics of its surface, you know, both in terms of geology and composition, you know, mineralogy, all that stuff. If it has an atmosphere, what's the general flavor of the atmosphere? If it has a magnetosphere, what's that look like? What do the moons around those planets look like if it has any? You know, if it's an asteroid and not a spherical object, what's the general shape of that asteroid? Is it mostly water and ice and mud, or is it mostly mud and a little bit of water and ice? Does it have heavy metals? You know, that kind of thing. But it gives you the size, shape, basic geology, basic mineralogy, what the resources are there, and gives you a feeling for how to get there with another mission later that can answer a whole bunch more specific questions. In certain places, as you know, like Mars, Titan, Enceladus, Europa, there's extremely interesting things happening on the surface with lakes on Titan and, you know, hot vents out of Enceladus, that kind of thing, oceans at Europa. And all of those places are very intriguing, some of which might have actually the right conditions for life. So the whole theme of water and life is going through a lot of these things. And but the interesting thing to me is that with all of this information, now the big question is, okay, what do we do with all this knowledge? You know, what do we do next?
Well, before you do that, what's the second-order question?
A second-order question would be, for example, say Europa. You know, we know now because of the Galileo mission, we know basically Europa is covered with ice, but it has cracks in the ice. There's a big ocean underneath it, underneath the ice caps and the ice surface. We know a little bit about the atmosphere around Europa, which partly is derived from what's venting out from underneath. And so the next order question with Europa is, how do we land on it, and how do we drill through the ice and put a probe into the ocean and see if it has any life in it? And there's missions being studied right now at JPL anyway to do that very thing. And that's pretty serious science. The Mars missions going on right now are answering second order and even third order questions, like the MER rovers that have been on the surface of Mars for years are answering questions like, did water ever exist at this site? If it did, what was its basic composition? Where is it now? You know, what sort of geology is there? What sort of mineralogy? What might have happened in the past? What's happening now? That kind of thing.
Okay.
So, but anyway, we're a lot smarter about the solar system compared to even 30 years ago, and we now have the technologies to go to most of these places if you're just willing to wait long enough. And it's really exciting to me that we pretty much know where we are now with all of that.
And so what do we do with it? As you said earlier, where do we go from here?
Right, and I think the big question for the long term is, how do we make all of that, all the solar system, somehow part of the key to answering all the questions we have on Earth here? You know, like the future of our planet as far as energy goes, as far as climate, as far as resources. The answers to all of those big questions are fairly directly connected with the rest of the solar system. We just haven't quite made all the connections yet, but we know there's a lot of potential there. You know, there's certainly infinite resources compared to the Earth in our local solar system even. You know, one small asteroid has a lot of resources we could use if we ever wanted to. And there's a whole other camp that think space solar power is the key to one of our energy futures. And whether you believe that or not, it's certainly true. There's a lot of energy out there to be used. And even understanding what's going on with our climate here is directly connected with what we understand about the other planets in the solar system.
So are we doing a pretty good job of planning for our future then, and how to capitalize on the wealth of information that we're learning?
When I look in the rearview mirror, just in the 35 years or so that I've been involved with a lot of these missions, either directly or tangentially, I've paid attention to most of this pretty well. But when you look in the rearview mirror, it actually looks like it was a pretty well-planned and executed program. You know, a lot of these missions hop from one lesson learned to the next, and they have a lot of synergy from one mission to the next, and there's not a huge amount of repetition as far as solar system exploration goes. Been a lot of failures, but we learned from those, and you know, we're getting better at it, but it's still really hard to do. But it's a lot like making sausage. You know, the process of getting all through that last 35 years wasn't really pretty, and almost every project's really hard to do, both from a technical point of view and management point of view. So it's not pretty when you look at the details under the hood, but when you kind of look at it from a distance, it's a really nice sequence of missions and discoveries. So I think that whole thing will continue, you know, that pattern. It just is really cumbersome sometimes when you're right in the trenches working on these programs. It's hard to lose sight of the facts of the big picture and how it all fits together. It's just really tough in the trenches to do some of this stuff. Very frustrating. So it's not uncommon for people in the field, no matter how good they are, to work their entire career just on 6 or 7 or 8 missions, and that's it. You know, and it's a little frustrating sometimes. So much to do.
So if you were planning our timeline into the future, what would you be doing?
Well, if I had infinite significant power and money, what would I do?
Yeah, you're the space czar or whatever the title would be.
Well, I appreciate the vision Elon Musk has as far as where he's trying to go with SpaceX, which is ultimately he would like to make sure that humans are on Mars in a sustainable way. And there's several reasons for that. It's an interesting place. It's practically about the only alternative for human expansion in the solar system, based on what we know now, because of the size, the resources, you know, the relative similarity to Earth, compared to some of the other extreme places like Venus, for example. And it's also an extremely good backup in case there's a large killer asteroid that hits the Earth someday and potentially could wipe out everybody and everything on Earth. So he's got this huge grand vision for Mars, and I tend to agree with that basic idea. And there's various ways to get there, but I've never thought the government leading that whole effort was the right answer, or governments, let's say. I don't think that's the way to do it. I think there has to be a commercial reason to do it. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. And so I know it's very controversial, but it's been in the news lately. There's an idea been floating around. I heard about it first in the early 90s, but it's a way to jumpstart that whole process. And that would be get some fairly large rockets built that can launch humans to Mars one way. And get them there one way, land them on the surface all in the same place, get them started building infrastructure and learning how to live on Mars. And there was a paper just published, I think a presentation made at a major scientific conference just a couple months ago, and it made a big splash in the news. And it was basically putting that idea on the table again in a more serious way. And I firmly believe if someone had the rockets to do that, you know, say it's SpaceX or some other consortium that had the rockets and the technology to do that, if you just took a sign-up list, I bet you'd get 10,000 people to volunteer to do that of all different ages.
Do you think governments would step in and not, I mean, you know, we always talk about how risk-averse we've become. Do you think any governments would step in and say, you're not doing a one-way mission, it's suicide, you can't do that?
Oh, I'm sure. That's why it's very controversial. It's not politically correct, but hey, that's how our whole country started, by the way, you know. if you want to use that example.
Well,
Jamestown was a pretty good example of that very same thing. It just didn't turn out the right way for them. But that's happened all through human history, that groups and clans go to places for a better future, and some make it, some don't, but it happens, and this is no different. But to me, that's going to save 10 or 20 years off the timeline if you do it that way versus trying to get everybody back every time.
Well, you know, if privates want to pay for it and they have their own rockets to do it and people are fully disclosed and this is what they want to do, what the hell, let them go do it.
That's what I'm thinking.
But I'll tell you, if the U.S. says no, or some of the European countries, I would be willing to bet that Russia and China would do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah. So
you pay the money and off you go.
Yeah. So, So that's a very controversial subject, but to me, that's the fastest way to get
off. Well, let me stop you. Why should that be controversial? Look how many people died going west in a Conestoga wagon on the various trails. I mean, you know, there was no assurance that you would get beyond St. Louis or Denver. Things like the Donner Party or history. Why should this be so controversial if we're not using taxpayer funding and people want to do it?
Exactly.
I mean, the government doesn't tell you, Rex, you're not going to be allowed to climb Mount Everest because of whatever. You have the money, you want to go do it, you do it, even if you kill yourself.
Yeah, that's why I think if the governments of the world get involved with a program like that, it'll never happen. But that's one reason I think it has to happen commercially or privately. So, and you could do the same thing with the moon. It's just maybe not as long-term in the history of the species. It's maybe not the right place to be setting up shop.
Paul,
only there.
Paul in Dallas, Texas, says one of the reasons why your idea might be controversial and it might not fly with governments is that there are no real property rights, and the treaties were designed for nation states, not for commercial or private enterprise. So if you're sending humans one way to the moon or to Mars and they're going to set up shop there, sure, there probably are ways to do it and still comply with the Outer Space Treaty, but in the absence of any regime for private property rights or anything like that, there probably is a voice that will grow louder and louder saying you have no business there.
Sure, yeah, and that's this whole issue of property rights is a big one. It's been around ever since I can remember, even in undergrad school. You know, Gerard O'Neill and his supporters back in the 70s raised those same issues, that if you're going to start trying to extract resources from the moon or asteroids, there's really not much of a legal framework to put all of that activity in the right context. So a big irony to me, you know, after seeing all this happen for 30, 35 years, is that we've gone essentially across the whole solar system now, and we still don't even have a basic strategy for dealing with the closest neighbor to the Earth, which is the moon. It's just weird to me that it's the moon is still like the wild, wild west, and there's almost no plan for the moon of any integrated sort. You know, there's some great science going on there now and recently, but as far as bringing the moon into the economic sphere of the world and all that, it's like there's no plan. It's not even in the dialogue on the airwaves, basically, and that's frustrating me.
It is. Listeners, again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223, and the email addresses that we're using today, dmlivings, with an S on it, at yahoo.com, or david@davidlivingston.com. Again, due to the storms in San Francisco. I'm looking at the bandwidth being really gobbled up on the streaming services, so use the toll-free number, listeners. Don't be shy, and don't wait until the program's going to end in 5 minutes, and then you start calling. So we want to hear from you. Okay, so what do we do about this? You know, no real plans to use the moon, which is the closest, and you know, they're building heavy lift. The private companies are not really talking about doing it and funding it out of their own pocket, and it's questionable if the government will build any heavy lift. And there are a lot of space enthusiasts and space advocates, many of whom you know and you meet at the conferences, who really don't subscribe to heavy lift at all, thinking instead that orbital refueling stations or propellant depots would negate or certainly minimize the need to even have heavy lift. So how do we sort it all out? And, again, you're the space star, remember. Step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where do we go from, let's write off 2010, it's a done year. Where do we go for 2011 and beyond in order to get humans to Mars?
Well, I'm a big fan of having seen this firsthand when I first started working at Hughes. I'm a big fan of what you might call elegant architectures, where some clever people come up with alternative approaches to doing something that commonly wants to be done by a lot of people, but they come up with a very clever way to do it, which usually turns out to be more direct and cheaper and more efficient everything. And an excellent example of that is, not even from the space business, is Southwest Airlines put together a fleet of very common 737 aircraft and managed to put about 10 or 12 other premises around those aircraft that no one else was putting together in just that right combination, and made it turn into the country's leading airline and the world's one of the world's leading airlines, and chronically one of the higher rated and most efficient airlines on the planet. And they're using essentially the same planes as a lot of other airlines are using, but they just put them together in a slightly different way and had some basic management practices that no one else put together in that combination. And that was a spectacular success. FedEx did the same thing with 747s and other big cargo jets and operated them in a different way and made a huge business out of it. And I believe for a lot of this talk about the future in space, ever since I can remember in the mid-70s, the vision, and this goes all the way back to von Braun, I think, the vision of what to do in space always started out with these very grandiose schemes and huge architectures with large rocket ships and huge space facilities in orbit and, you know, lunar bases and Mars transfer craft and everything. And I don't think anybody really has articulated how to get from our modest little roots right now where we are to those grand visions. And so the challenge is, how do we get from here to there? You know, all those visions are really cool, but no one's really articulated how do you get from where we are right now to there. And I think the step-by-step approach that especially Virgin Galactic and SpaceX are taking now, is it just feels right to me, where you start by addressing a niche that you think you can do technically pretty well. You get it operating pretty much under your own control, so you can control the outcome of things in your own schedule pretty much. And you just prove that you can do certain things really well, and then you expand from there. So, and you sort of build in options in your architecture for expansion later without having to reinvent the wheel like we normally see in our own government programs.
So incremental and step by step.
Yeah, and so, you know, you can just see it in the news releases from SpaceX, for example. They started with their Falcon 1 rocket just to prove they could build any kind of a rocket, and then they very quickly morphed that into the Falcon 9 using very similar architectures. And now we see they've launched that twice. The Dragon capsule that was on this launch was basically the shell of a capsule and a cargo vehicle, but it wasn't a full-blown, you know, human-rated capsule. But it clearly has an evolutionary path to be a human-rated vehicle, and that's been their plan all along. And it has plenty of maneuvering capabilities, so it can rendezvous and dock with other modules, you know, space station, for example. And it's a very well thought out evolutionary path, and all they have to do is just keep executing and learn from those things, learn from those missions, and they'll be much farther along in a few years and can do bigger and better things. Elon's showing right now how you can scale up the Falcon 9 in a modular way to be a heavy lifter vehicle. He's got several versions of that. He's got plans to upgrade his engines. And, you know, at least he's going through that process of showing incrementally how you get from here to there. Virgin Galactic's doing something similar where, they fairly directly scaled up the Spaceship One architecture to the Spaceship Two architecture. They're testing that system right now. You know, it looks like it's going to be it's a plausible vehicle for what they're trying to do. They're claiming very soon now that at least Richard Branson said they're going to be submitting proposals for supplying an orbital service, and I'm not sure what that vehicle is going to look like. I'm not sure it's going to be Spaceship Two-like, but you never know. But you know, they certainly have a lot of smart people, and I'm anxious to see what they come up with. Bigelow, if you remember, launched a couple of subscale modules of what they're trying to build several years ago. Those worked really well, both of them. I think they're both still operating in orbit. They're unmanned modules, but they're very good subscale versions of what they intend to build in a bigger scale soon. And he has several growth options of his modules, which are all basically the same architecture, just different sizes, and they're all dependent on cost-effective crew transportation up and down and cargo supply and also the launch vehicles to launch the modules in the first place. And I think he's doing all the right steps to line all that stuff up. You know, he's lockstep with Boeing on working on capsule designs, and I think that's all a really great plan. And even Space Adventures has done a really good job of capitalizing on the existing infrastructure that's available by buying seats on the Soyuzes when they're available, and they have plans to evolve that basic business model to dedicated orbital missions that may or may not go to space station, and they even have a lunar mission option they're trying to sell, which all uses existing architectures that pretty much exist from Russia. So, to me, that's the right approach. It just maybe takes longer than most people would like, but you just can't jump into these grandiose visions of the future without figuring out how to get there from here. And I just love this incremental approach. That's exactly what I saw at Hughes. They built various versions of their spinning spacecraft for decades that worked really well. They managed to find ways to scale them up in power and telecom capability and propulsion. And they were all fairly incremental, logical steps from where they learned how to operate earlier. And that's the right way to do it, I think.
Carla in Berkeley, California, in my area, says, do you think NASA does a good job of the incremental step-by-step approach in their mission planning and how they carry out their missions? I'm specifically thinking of how they did with Constellation, which appears to be canceled.
In general, I think both NASA, to some extent the DOD, you know, what part of it I appreciate, because I don't know what goes on in the classified world much, but in general, NASA and its major contracting firms have a habit of getting a system to work and then discarding that and going on to something brand new, and often not carrying through with what worked before and applying it to the next mission. And I'm not saying it happens all the time, but I think it happens way too much compared to, say, the Russian program, which is probably on the other extreme, which starts with something in the 60s, and they're pretty much launching systems that were developed in the 60s. But a good example that I have in my mind, for example, a recent one, is the two rovers on Mars, Spirit and Opportunity, were terrific little craft. They've done a great job of exploring their little parts of Mars that they landed in. And those systems worked really well twice. And, you know, if I had a control over the purse strings at NASA, I would at least have an ongoing series of those going back to Mars and not stopping all that and then starting over with a much, much bigger rover that, as we all know, has made a big impact on the Mars budget lately because they've overrun their budget so much. And I wish that once we get systems working, we could just at least build a few more. A contrast to that is in the 70s, NASA launched Skylab and had several missions on that thing. That was basically a clever way to reuse some parts left over from Apollo, and I thought it was a terrific application of clever engineering to make some use out of what normally might have been junk. And so it's a mixed bag, but I think we reinvent the wheel far too often in the spirit of trying to sound high-tech and, you know, claim we're pioneering new things. But sooner or later, you got to worry about the money, too. And there's a lot of ways we could reuse what we've learned and try it again a few more times.
excuse me. Listeners, we're going to take our next break. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we'll be back with our third segment with Rex. 3 minutes. Don't go anyplace. Stay dry.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Friday Space Show. Our guest today is Rex Ridenour. We're talking about Ecliptic, his company, space policy, his 35 years of experience in the space world. I know, Rex, you wanted to follow up with that last question from segment two about NASA and Constellation.
Yeah, I didn't quite answer that question as asked, but the point I wanted to make is when I first heard about the architecture that was coming out of all of those studies that eventually became Constellation, I didn't have so much an issue with the designs that they came up with, you know, the architectures with the stick rocket and the larger Ares V and all of that. I don't claim to be a rocket designer by any stretch, but, you know, the first order they were trying to reuse what they had learned from shuttle, especially with some of the tooling and whatnot, and the systems, trying to address the issue of a crew next to the booster, so they put everything on top. You know, that was something Mike Griffin insisted on. So all that's fine and good, but stepping back and just watching all that happen, my basic premise from all of that activity was that, hey, these are the same people that brought us shuttle and space station, basically, and same contractors. Why are we ever going to expect the recurring costs of each mission to be any lower than shuttle? That was my question, and as it turned out, that's what largely was found by the Augustine Commission and other folks was that the recurring cost to operate all of this stuff was going to be prohibitively expensive, not to mention the development costs. And in my mind, that whole Constellation program missed the entire point of our next generation of launch systems, which was to get the recurring costs down so we can do other things with that money. And that's why I'm so upbeat about SpaceX, for example, because you know, the privately held commercial company with something like $600 million has done far more for that money than the government-directed program ever did. And I've even heard that the launch tower for Ares 1, which was never going to be used now, but just the launch tower for Ares 1 cost about $500 million. And that's about what Elon spent to get to his first Falcon 9 launch. And to me, that's just, as a taxpayer, it's obscene how much that cost to get to where they were on Constellation. And so, you know, it's not to denigrate the people doing all of that work. They're given kind of a loaded deck already when they decide to work on those programs, because the government money comes with so many other strings attached that there's no way they're going to get the cost down anyway. It's fundamentally a jobs program, at least from the senators in the states that get the money, well, from their point of view. And once you start distributing the work on a big system like that to any number of states and NASA centers and contractors, the costs go sky high because it takes so much to coordinate all that. And so they're never going to get around that as long as the government strings are attached. And that's why I have a lot more optimism about the commercial approach. Very cost effective.
When you sell RocketCam to NASA, I'm just wondering what you have to go through in order to qualify RocketCam to fly on the shuttle.
Well, one thing we do, and it's our much preferred approach, is we much prefer to have customers be other companies and not directly the government. So 90-something percent of all of our contracts have been with other companies or other labs like Aerospace Corporation or Applied Physics Lab or somebody like that.
Uh-huh.
We rarely try to chase contracts that directly involve getting on contract with the government, because that comes with a lot of extra overhead and hassle that I'd rather not deal with, frankly. And by and large, our orders come from the prime integrating contractors for these different rockets and spacecraft anyway, so it's kind of a natural flow anyway to come from a company to us. But generally, there's a fairly rigorous set of specifications on the environmental testing that we have to put all this hardware through to survive the rugged vibration launch environment, the temperature swings, either during the ascent if you're on a rocket or once you're in orbit if you're on a spacecraft. In some cases on spacecraft applications, the space radiation requirements affect our design, especially if we're supposed to last more than a few weeks or months. You know, if it's years, we have to do something special. We often have to worry about outgassing and make sure our equipment doesn't outgas on the other host platform's equipment. And various quality assurance provisions, like how you assemble your harnesses and how you connect your connectors, all that kind of stuff. And so we do that pretty well, and that generally gets you technically in the right box so you can be on these vehicles in the first place. Contracting-wise, we, because of the nature of our investor, who first helped me start the company, who's still our chairman, he absolutely wanted us to be as commercial as we could and not get into this government contracting trap that a lot of companies get into. And so we do everything firm fixed price from a catalog of stuff that we sell. And therefore, all of our contracts typically come to us as purchase orders or fairly simple contracts, and nothing terribly complicated. We never get into the cost-plus kind of contracting. I don't even claim to understand it, but I know I don't like it. And, in fact, in the almost 10 years of our company, the very first proposal I had to write to actually win a RocketCam contract, I just submitted in October. We never had to write a proposal before that. We were either sole-sourced the work or, just because of our brand recognition and good track record, you know, people just called us anyway because they didn't want to call anybody else. So that we're kind of a very strange company in that regard. We have a fairly simple, easy system for getting on contract, and it works pretty well. But I tell you, there's all kinds of very complicated ways to work the procurement, and I'd rather not go there, frankly.
Let me give you a question from Jim, who is in Reno, Nevada today. First of all, again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. And email is david@davidlivingston.com, or you can use dmlivings with an S on it at yahoo.com. So Jim in Reno says, do you think that the current space policy debate going on between with Congress as well as many different segments of the industry is going to end up in being severely damaged by possible budget cuts coming out of the new Congress and as a result of our global and domestic economic conditions? If the budget cuts come, is this really detriment, I can't even talk this morning, is this really a detriment to space moving forward as you're describing it, or is the private sector strong enough to move forward anyway?
That's an excellent question, and it should be on everybody's mind. I do think there's a high risk of our government finally trying to rein in the deficits and spreading that pain across all the different agencies. I don't think NASA by any means is going to be immune from that. I think it's quite loony, actually, how the certain senators in certain states are arguing that a significant portion of NASA's budget should not go to some of these commercial firms to get these commercial crew systems developed, because the only logical alternative, if they don't do that, is pay all that money to the Russians. And in my mind, that's like our senator saying they trust Russian agencies and companies more than they trust our own companies and agencies. And to me, that's just crazy. So that's a different argument we can get into. But I believe there's a few companies that I think have the wherewithal and they know what's going on enough to insulate themselves somewhat from that sort of impact. And I would assume and hope that SpaceX, Bigelow and Orbital Sciences in particular are making plans to keep going forward even without significant NASA money. I know each one of those firms is sort of counting on some of this NASA money to move things along a little faster, but I think they have enough wherewithal to get that money from other places and maybe get their stuff done only slower without NASA at all. And Virgin Galactic all along never really has counted much on the NASA funding as a market anyway, so I don't think they're going to be impacted much at all, and I think they'll go ahead no matter what. I think it's prudent for all these companies, as soon as they can get to the position where the NASA influence is irrelevant, the better. And I know it's in the hallway talk at conferences and other conversations I've had with people involved with some of these companies, there's a general feeling emerging that, if NASA and our government doesn't get organized quickly, in the next 2 or 3 years, pretty soon NASA and all of that will be fairly irrelevant to what's going on. And these companies will just go ahead and do it the way they want to do it and just say, well, you can come along for the ride if you want, but otherwise you're not a partner. So right now they're kind of playing nice with each other, but I don't think these companies are going to wait for NASA to get their act together too much longer.
Well, then, the follow-up would be, okay, what do you think the investor climate would be like? I'm talking about the professionals, not the angels or maybe even the venture capital, but the real sophisticated ones. If they see NASA and the governments pulling back, does that indicate to them that maybe space is less worthy of a commercial investment?
Yeah, I'm not a venture capitalist by any means, but my general sense is if the government is pulling back, to first order, that means they're pulling back because the government doesn't have enough money
right
to fund everything they want to do. And I would assume if the people that make decisions are thinking about all this correctly, that if the government's short on money, they should be buying rockets for the best possible price they can get them for. And I would think that would actually play in the hands favorably for someone like SpaceX. Because fairly soon, if not right now, if you go on a SpaceX website, they should be offering their Falcon 9 rocket for a much lower price than you can get similar rockets other places. And I would think if the government's really trying to save money, they should probably boost their orders at SpaceX, not reduce them. Because there's no alternative right now to those kinds of prices.
No, they usually cut the mission back and the demand back rather than look for a better way to do their original plans.
Yeah, well,
they're not
a lot of SpaceX's business from NASA is going to be resupplying space station, and our government just decided to keep that going until 2020. So I think the only way they're going to scale back on the orders for SpaceX for those cargo resupply missions, or orbital for that matter, is to scale back on their promises to keep space station going, and I don't know if our government's willing to do that to save money. I doubt it. It's a too high-profile project for them. And that's not to comment on the value of using space station or not, but I think our government's made a high-level policy decision to keep that going. And I don't see them changing that one.
Randy is in Virginia someplace by email again. And Randy says, do you think it's a good idea for the government to invest in converting EELVs to human spaceflight? Or if they're going after commercial business, should the conversion be the responsibility of the companies that own the rockets?
My favorite approach would be for the commercial users of those rockets that want to use them for crew transport to pay for that development themselves. And Bigelow's already done some of that. He's actually paid United Launch Alliance going back several years ago to start looking at how to convert the Atlas V into a crew-capable vehicle. And I have no idea how much of that's going on now, but I would favor the commercial companies just getting together and deciding what they're going to do to make that happen. I know that's a fairly serious issue on the table because there's a conference planned just about a month from now in Boulder to discuss for about a day and a half, 2 days. What does it mean to have a human-rated launch vehicle, and what are we going to do to crisp up the requirements for that so we can go ahead and do it? And it's mostly going to be companies coming together to talk about that. There will be a few NASA folks there, I'm sure. But I think the companies are already self-organizing to figure out how to do that. And part of the irony here is if you really push NASA to explain what it means to have a crew-rated vehicle, their answer is very fuzzy right now. They don't really know what to tell you.
Except they've been human rating all their vehicles, so they should know what that process is and be able to write it out, right?
Yeah, but you may have read in the online news the last couple of weeks, Wayne Hale, who used to run the shuttle program.
Right. We talked about his blog on the show.
Yeah, and he reviewed that first draft that came out about what a human rated set of requirements looks like, and he thought it was a piece of junk, frankly. You know. So that's embarrassing, you know, after 50 years of human space travel led by our government, that's the best they could come up with. That's embarrassing. So the companies are self-organizing to come up with a smarter set of requirements that still make sense and are still useful and safe and all that. And I think if they don't get some clarity out of our government on what that means, they're going to figure out all of that on their own anyway and go ahead and do it.
Would NASA accept what they're doing, given your experience and understanding of these relationships?
Well, I would hope so, but I can't say whether they would or not. But if you fast forward 6 or 7 years and, you know, NASA's off on the sidelines with half the crew size they have now, half the astronaut core size, because they're going to have to scale that down from 64 to something like half. You know, logically they would. But if they're sitting there 6 or 7 years from now with no shuttle of their own, their space station up there, and all the former NASA astronauts that used to work for NASA are now going up on these launch vehicles commercially to Bigelow space stations and whatnot, it's going to make NASA look really silly to not be going along for the ride. But it's their choice, you know. But I think if they want to sit on the sidelines and watch all the commercial astronauts go up and back, you know, that's their choice. I know there will be, before this decade's out, certainly hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands of new astronauts created from these commercial companies. Especially if you add the suborbital in there from folks like Virgin Galactic.
Well,
I think that's a done deal. And so fairly soon, the fact that the government has astronauts, at least in this country, is going to be relatively a minor issue. There will be a lot of commercial astronauts, too.
Well, one can only hope that as everybody incrementally evolves through this process, that wisdom evolves as well.
Yeah, I'm always hopeful there's more wisdom in certain places than it actually turns out to be, but I hope for the best sometimes.
Well, you're better hoping for the best than the worst, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, a good rule I learned a long time ago, which is always a good rule, is, you know, hope for the best, plan for the worst. And I'm pretty sure folks like SpaceX, Bigelow, and the other leading companies in this arena are planning for the worst, but hoping things are a little better than that.
As we are coming toward the winding down of the program, a couple of things. For people who will hear the program when it goes to archives, do you give out an email address for additional questions, or do you want me to filter for you?
No, I'm fine getting questions. Probably the easiest to remember is just rexridenauer@gmail.com.
No dot between the deals and the names or anything, right?
No, just, and my last name's spelled R-I-D-E-N-O-U-R-E. That's an easy one to remember for most
people. I don't know how many syllables are in it. So one syllable is easy to remember. Pearls of wisdom, or what should we have talked about that we have forgotten or we omitted? This is... you know, the chance to add in what we should have done or what we omitted, or your pearls of wisdom. How would you like to leave us?
Well, one comment about what we're doing at Ecliptic. We're a small firm, but fortunately what we're doing sometimes has very good visibility because of the nature of, you know, generating this video on board these vehicles. And one thing I'm enjoying is that I know there's, you know, millions of people that want to go in space someday, and they follow all this fairly closely, and they actually would like to go up there someday. And a lot of the folks that are able to do so have already paid their tickets with Virgin Galactic, and they're actually going to go. But if you can't do that, and all you can do is read the news and watch what's going on from afar, I feel good about the fact that often on these missions, our systems are providing the view that everybody would like to see themselves, which is the onboard view. And there's a lot of that happening going forward from here. We've got at least a dozen or 15 launches scheduled next year. And, you know, on many of these high-profile missions, we'll be at the moon next year with Grail on both spacecraft, with four cameras on each spacecraft looking down at the moon, video cameras. That's pretty exciting. And... So if you're interested in following things but you can't afford a ticket on Virgin Galactic or Bigelow or somebody like that, watch our videos. And we do have a Facebook site now for all of this. I think later next year we're going to have a YouTube site as well. But it's just Rocket Cam by Ecliptic is the name of the Facebook page. And there's about 100 video clips on there now that people can just enjoy. A lot of shuttle stuff, a lot of Deltas and Atlases and other cool missions.
So for those that are on Facebook, if they just do a search for Rocket Cam, they probably find you.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
And then they can add to your fan page or whatever it is.
Yeah, just a few weeks ago it passed the 1,000 mark for friends, which I'm proud of.
And you know every single one of them intimately, right?
No, I gave up a long time ago to keep track of it. But that's a good – it's the best source of Rocket Cam video you'll see, and it's fun to watch. There's hours of video on there. The other thing I would say is I really think the signs we're seeing, especially with this SpaceX launch a few days ago, really show that these commercial companies aren't just lucky. You know, they know what they're doing, some of them. And I'm really upbeat about the fact that they're making progress and showing their stripes and showing they can actually do these hard missions. And so I just can't wait till the end of this decade when all this stuff starts playing out and Virgin Galactic is operating, SpaceX is doing routine missions to the space station and who knows where else, and all kinds of cool things are happening. I actually have been working 35 years. I could work another 35 years just because there's so much to enjoy to watch and be part of. So I'm really looking forward to the next 30. It's going to be terrific.
Let me ask you the last question that has come in, okay? Mm-hmm. Andrew is in Reston, Virginia. Mm. Pretty far away, right? Andrew says, you've talked about Bigelow, and you've talked about Orbital a little bit, and you've talked about SpaceX, and you've talked about Virgin, but you haven't mentioned any of the other new space companies, like X-Corp, which is in the game, Bezos and his operation, though not much is known about it, Masten, which has certainly won contest and awards. So have you deliberately omitted them, and why, or is this an oversight?
Good question. It's mostly the fact that there's limited time on this show, and I'm also trying to guess about which companies most of these listeners have heard about. But one that wasn't mentioned in that short list just now is Sierra Nevada Corporation. Their space systems group just growing like crazy in Boulder. I think they're actually going to make some really cool things happen as well. They're a combination of Microsat Systems, Space Dev, StarSys, and some recent growth. But they're really on a tear. They're building all sorts of small spacecraft. They're putting together the first prototype of the Dream Chaser crew vehicle, and have lots of plans to do big things in space. So they're worth watching just as much as the other firms. I love what Bezos is doing with Blue Origin, but as everybody knows, there's almost no information about what they're doing, so it's hard to comment on it. But
right.
I do think they're credible. I know some of the people that have either been overseeing what they're doing as peer review board people or actually have worked there, and they're all credible, and so I wish them all the greatest luck. I just don't know what they're doing. They don't tell you.
Well, I actually admire them for keeping it close to the chest.
Yeah, that's more my style, too, so I appreciate it.
I do, too. I think blowing out all the rhetoric and making promises and never being able to perform or fulfill is just total garbage. So I have great respect for Blue. I don't know the people. I've never had an interview with them. This is just arm's length distance. I respect their keeping it tight and close to the chest in before they make progress or announce their progress.
Yeah, but you know, literally with them, you know, it's literally just watch this space. You know, something cool is going to happen. I just don't know what it is.
Or when it is, right?
Or when. But they're credible. I can tell. And also, there's any number of Google Lunar X Prize teams, you know, and I used to be deputy manager on one of them.
Which one was that again?
The Southern California Selene Group.
And what happened? You're not there anymore?
The whole team was shut down by the team founder, and that's a whole different story that I won't get into here. But it was a philosophical disagreement between the team and the X Prize Foundation about how that whole story is going to be spun up someday. But there was a cool spinning lander concept that came out of that Ecliptic now has the patent for, and I'll be presenting that at a conference next June at the low-cost planetary missions conference, you know, what that all means. It's a direct derivative from all the spinning spacecraft that were built at Hughes, and same people involved that developed all those. But there's one Google Lunar X Prize team that I'm just recently aware of that's Moon Express. That sounds like they have a very credible team. They're worth watching. They haven't really explained much about what they're doing, but I would watch them also. Masten and Armadillo and X-Corp all have, nifty little systems that actually have, shown they have some workable technology that can be built into some operating systems. And I think all three of those are worth watching to see where they go. I don't see those businesses scaling up as much as some of the other ones I talked about, and I really think what's needed to attract investors and, you know, headlines and lots of global press are these bigger companies that seem to be on a path to grow to be billion-dollar companies. That's what attracts attention.
Right.
I don't see the other companies or even most of the XPRIZE teams right now that I know of. If they're just going for the prize, they're not going to be billion-dollar companies. But, boy, so the first company that looks like they're a billion-dollar company is going to start attracting headlines, and I think SpaceX is very close to that, and Virgin will be soon.
So, listeners, you know, you need to hear what he just said because it's really important. Having the legitimate potential to become a billion-dollar company and make a lot of money is a capital acquisition attractive process, tool, and mechanism. Doing anything a lot smaller than that relegates you to a different category of investors, a different category of funding, and for the most part, it's probably a harder road to haul because you need to – it's not the mom and pops, but you need to be able to get enough money to and probably avoid public registration, and I believe the number is still 35 or 40. I'm not sure how it got changed in the financial reform bill that Congress passed earlier this year. But clearly the advantages go if investors think that this can be a billion-dollar company rather than a $10 million company or something like that. So that is an important thing to understand, especially in the kind of economy that we have right now.
And as people may know, there's a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines and has been for years.
Right.
Downturn because there was no good place to put some of it.
Well, that and the uncertainty on government policy and regulation and taxation and this and that and the other, who knows? I mean, you know, you're maybe safer in, you're not safer in a euro, are you?
But I was in the Bay Area last week for 3 days talking with folks that are, you know, one step removed from these wealthy entrepreneurs that have already made it big up there.
Yeah.
Some of whom have already invested in SpaceX. And the general buzz I heard in the conversations I had was that with the success of SpaceX, nearly flawless mission end-to-end, you know, the checkbooks were opening, and they're about to start writing more checks to invest in SpaceX. So, you know, I think you'll expect to see some fresh new orders with their rockets from different customers and maybe some existing customers they already have, and I expect announcements about future investments coming in soon.
On the private side, he's not ready yet to do an IPO, or did you hear him or hear that they're thinking of an IPO?
I've heard rumors about that for a couple of years, but I haven't heard anything directly that would indicate that. But I hope he actually stays private for another 5 years so they can control their destiny a little more.
Yeah, absolutely. Because once you go public, it's a whole nother ball game.
Yeah. So I mean, one thing I saw at Hughes when I was there, it was a completely private company owned by the Howard Hughes Medical Research Institute. It was a way Howard Hughes set it up to be private.
And right.
That just made all the difference in the world with executing strategies and things. It was terrific. So I'm a big fan of that mode.
Absolutely. Anything else you'd like to add before we log off for the day?
Well, I think this next decade, you know, through about 2020, is just going to be terrific in many different respects, as we kind of touched on here. But I think if by the end of this decade or so, we don't have the notion of the solar system and all of its resources and all of its potential somehow part of the ongoing dialogue about the world economy and the future of the world and the future problems of the world, if that isn't part of the dialogue every single day, that space is part of that solution, I think we've done something wrong.
So okay, Rick.
It's a huge thing to get that into the dialogue the next 5 or 6, 7 years.
We have remember I said callers don't wait until the show ends to call? So somebody called and is on the line. So do you want to stay to take the call?
Sure.
Caller, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
So why do you call when the show's about to end instead of during the show? I'd like to understand this psychology, please.
Well, I just thought of a question. You're still on the air.
Who are you and where are you from, please?
This is Elliot Nixon in Michigan.
Go for it.
Hi, Elliot.
Okay, my question is in regards to the geostationary industry that you're your guest has experienced them. I'm wondering why we haven't seen a shift in the satellite architecture towards smaller satellites. I would have thought with the computer industry's ability to manufacture a satellite computer smaller and smaller, would have seen a shift towards the actual size of the satellites being smaller, and thus having a decrease in the value of larger launch vehicles. I wonder if it's a bandwidth limitation on the receiver dish, or what's the issue? Why aren't we seeing the communication satellites shrink in size? Thank you. I'm sorry for waiting the last minute.
No problem. And I haven't been actively involved with geosynchronous satellites for 20 years, but my general sense of what's going on is that, as you might appreciate, if you can make the antennas and the power levels on the geosynchronous satellites bigger and more, you know, so bigger antennas and more power going into the antennas on the satellite, it shrinks what you need on the ground to communicate with that satellite. And so if you remember 20 years ago, the typical satellite dish that everybody had to receive their cable station at home was a C-band dish that was outside, you know, in the backyard that looked like it was half the size of a small swimming pool, you know, 3 or 4 meters across or something. Nowadays, everybody has a little dish and DirecTV dishes that probably cost $4 to make, and they're on every rooftop, and sometimes you see apartment buildings with 30 of them on there. And that's because the satellites have gotten big and powerful. And the same reason you can now communicate with mobile devices through satellites instead of through terrestrial networks is because the satellites are so big and so powerful. And the other advantage of having a big satellite, once you do that part of it, you know, with the lots of power and big antennas, then you have the volume on board the satellite to put lots and lots and lots of transponders, which are the things that turn the data around up and down. So that feeds in also to a very efficient way to create more channels for data or video. So that's why you have 200 and 300 channels on your cable, because the satellites have that many transponders on them. And so as a business, since they've by and large figured out how to make these things last 10 or 15 years, as a business, it just makes more sense to put as much power and as many antennas on there as you can afford to put on and put lots of transponders, and it's a very efficient business model. And so those companies, if they're operated well, literally print money after they pay for the satellites. And there's no way to accomplish all that with small satellites. There's absolutely no way. It's a physics problem.
That's a well-explained answer. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's the core reason right there, is it's just much more efficient to do it that way.
Elliot, thanks for calling into the show. We appreciate it.
Thanks for the question.
Yeah, thank you both. Bye-bye.
You know, does the fact that they can now launch multiple satellites off of one rocket add to this, so that you're actually, you know, dividing your launch costs by the number of different satellites that are going on to that? So clearly you'd want to get as much bang for your buck on that launch. And if you can get multiple satellites going on the same launch that provide huge bang for the buck, you're even better off.
Yeah, and in fact, Orbital takes advantage of that, because they've sort of migrated themselves into taking over the small geosynchronous satellite market.
Uh-huh.
Large, and they often are on a rocket with at least one other satellite. And their satellites are like the size satellites were 20 years ago, built by some of the other companies. And they're not huge, but they're big enough to provide some services to people. So they're right in that range where they can take advantage of the really big rockets and launch one at a time, two at a time.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a whole exciting area that most people don't appreciate, but huge business.
Absolutely.
Hundreds of billions of dollars.
Rex, you'll have to return far sooner than 2 years, okay?
Well, maybe when I get this spinning lander paper all done and I'm about to present it, or will present it at the conference next June, that'd be good.
Well, let me know, and we'd be glad to have you back on and talk about it.
Very good. Hey, thank you, David.
Thank you, and my best to you and your family and all of Ecliptic for a great upcoming holiday, Christmas, and New Year's. And let's hope that everybody moves into 2011 and we start having great years.
Be exciting, and thanks to all the listeners and the folks that either emailed or called in questions too.
That's right, and listeners, come back Sunday show. Hopefully Exo Communication in San Francisco will have found a way to restore its power. So come back, and we're talking to Dr. Sean Casey. We're going to do updates on Sophia. He's part of a Lunar X Prize team, and be an interesting show on Sunday. You don't want to miss it. So thank you, Rex, for being on the Space Show, and for everybody else, have a great upcoming weekend. Goodbye from the Space Show.
Goodbye, all.